Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden on Vectis Radio FM 104.6. We are chatting art, transport, communications, history. That's a CATCH. It's the Catchcast, and we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our wonderful geeky subjects as myself and the very kind guests. In this edition, we speak with one of the world's foremost commentators on the state of our cities. How are we getting things wrong, and how could we put it right? Direct from New York City, welcome to the Catchcast, Benjamin Schneider.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Well, thanks for being here, Ben. And we are going to revel in your new book, The Unfinished Metropolis, very soon. But I wonder if we can just start the ball rolling by taking you back a little bit and ask, what were you interested in as a child?
Yes, that's a really important question for my origin story. And fortunately, I do have a perfect answer, which is that as a child, I was obsessed with maps. I could read maps before I could read text. So I have a long history of being fascinated by cities and by architecture as well. I always loved looking at buildings and getting books, photo books of architecture. So that was sort of this part of me in my DNA, I think, that is just fascinated by cities, that has always been with me.
Crikey, I didn't know that you were so keen on maps, and you've already won yourself to my heart being a cartographer. Did you do your own fantasy maps and stuff? Did you draw your own maps?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And even up until my early 20s, I have been known to create some fantasy transit maps of cities in which I've lived.
I just think it's almost a rite of passage, isn't it, for people who love the idea of transit and who believe in the concept of people taking trains and public transport. The idea that you could create your own fantasy city with an extension of your favorite metro line right to your own house, it's just what you have to do, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think the connective tissue to my work today is that I love the idea of capturing a future moment in time of a city. I find that very exciting to sort of project forward and imagine what a city can be with a better transit system, for instance. And that is kind of what I'm trying to do in a textual form with, you know, my urban exploration in my book.
So did you use any of your interest in architecture and transit map making to go and study things at college then, Ben?
Sort of. I studied urban studies at Columbia University, which is more like sociology and looped in with a little bit of economics and political science, basically many perspectives on understanding cities in a deep way. And I didn't really use any technical or artistic skill in that major, but certainly the subject matter was exactly aligned. It was understanding cities, how they work, where they're headed, why they're important.
So you were studying over on the east side of the country. I'm speaking to you now in New York City, but some of your first jobs were over in California, I believe.
Yes, that's right. So I grew up in San Francisco. And then shortly after college, a year after I graduated, I moved back out to San Francisco and worked out there as a local reporter and a freelance journalist for a period of time, covering local politics, local urban development there. So that was very illuminating moment in my career to get that ground floor perspective on how things actually work in terms of urban policy making.
And at those media outlets, did you find much of an open door to the way that you view things, or did you have difficulty in getting articles commissioned that were about your favorite subjects?
Yeah, well, you know, I was very fortunate. I was at SF Weekly, which is an alt-weekly newspaper that sadly does not regularly publish anymore, and the San Francisco Examiner, one of the two daily newspapers in San Francisco. And at both places, the editors were very interested in urbanism. And I think my time there 4 or 5 years ago that I was working there corresponded with the rise of the YIMBY movement, which began in San Francisco, and a sort of reckoning across San Francisco, California, and then I think now the entire US, maybe now even the whole Anglosphere, the UK as well, and other places, that our cities are not adding housing commensurate with demand. And that's part of this larger issue we have with not being able to build big, ambitious things that can transform people's lives for the better. So there was an appetite for that kind of journalism that I was really glad to help fill.
Hey, I don't think NIMBYism is restricted to your part of the world.
No.
We have plenty of people who don't like the idea of things being built in their backyard all over this side of the pond as well, I can tell you. Is that when you began your Substack commenting on urban environment?
That was actually after I moved to New York.
Right.
Yeah, I have a Substack called The Urban Condition that I kind of created concurrently with developing the book, The Unfinished Metropolis. sort of as like a reporter's notebook, a place to have a more casual mode of covering cities. And it's been interesting how the book and the Substack kind of feed on one another. I think people who read my Substack, my very few dedicated readers who've read close to every post, will find that the book has quite a bit of material that is connected to what has been written in the Substack, albeit in kind of a deeper, a little more analytical way.
Now, we're going to get into the real nitty-gritty and details of your book in a little while, but I got to ask you, I hope you don't mind me asking this question, and you may not even want to answer this. Do you feel that the subjects you're covering are getting more or less of a hearing given the current political situation in the US?
It's complicated. I think the horizons of our imagination here in the US are curtailed by the state of the federal government, the Trump administration's broad defunding of federal programs, particularly in this case, those that are connected to housing and transportation and planning. Those are all areas that the Trump administration is looking to cut and has already cut in some instances. And broadly, the administration's kind of anti-city stance, you know, looking to score points by creating spectacles in cities and stoking conflict in cities. So that is certainly a challenge to urbanists. On the other hand, I think this so-called abundance movement that has been kicked off by Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson's book of that name, which is a huge bestseller here in the US, has sort of created an invitation for people on the left side of the political spectrum to dream bigger in a way, even if the actual path to executing some of those dreams is very unclear. But that book basically implores people to be ambitious in how they're thinking about what a better society could look like and how politics can help get us there. So I think those are two conflicting strains that are both in operation at the same time.
We're used to seeing images on the screen of US cities full of modern skyscrapers and looking very glitzy. But before we get into a real deep dive on the state of those places, and maybe you could just sum up for us what the reality is for people living in those American cities, please, Ben.
Yeah, well, the reality is that housing costs are extremely high in American cities, and that leads to the epidemic of homelessness that we have in our cities. And beyond that, our transportation systems are in a really sorry state, very poorly maintained. So the cities look good from bird's eye view often, but there's some really deep challenges at ground level that people experience every day.
So the glamour's all really on the surface, I suppose.
Yes. And, you know, the transformation of big city downtowns, all those skyscrapers, I think belies a lack of transformation almost everywhere else, you know, in more residential neighborhoods that are frozen in amber by things like single family zoning that prevents America from building enough housing to house everyone.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you have a new book out soon called The Unfinished Metropolis, Igniting the City, Building Revolution. And before we really go super deep dive into that, I just want to ask you what convinced you to turn all this into a book effectively?
Well, there's been a good number of books recently published in the US that cover specific elements of urbanism. A good number of books on housing. The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein was a huge book on the history of racist housing policies in America. A number of others on issues like parking, downtown revitalization, etc. But I didn't feel like there was a book that kind of brought those themes together and showed how they're interconnected, and also brought in other subject matter like the story of freeways in the U.S. and also the story of high-speed rail or the lack thereof in the U.S. And, you know, I think it's you can't really understand those discrete areas without putting them up to the light of these other pieces of urban planning and development. So that was my goal going into this book, to bring everything together and put it in a package that was very accessible and entertaining for people to read.
That's very nice. So effectively, you're just putting all this kind of thing in context and saying, hang on, we can't discuss one without thinking about the other, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the book runs to, I think it's about 300 pages. It's quite an achievement, Benjamin.
Thank you. How
did you go about all your research on such a major work?
Yeah, I mean, it took a long time. It was over a two-year process. And it's more art than science, I would say. There wasn't a perfect formula for figuring it all out. But basically, I read as much as I could on you know, each of those subjects that I mentioned and more: housing, transportation, commercial development, a lot of history, a lot of public policy work, a lot of consulting, zoning codes, and reading white papers from think tanks, and also even some movies and novels that kind of illustrate some of the phenomena that I'm looking at. I tried to vacuum up as much of that information as I could and then find a narrative that held each chapter together. And then beyond that, finding narratives and themes that hold the chapters respectively together. And I had a lot of help from my editor in kind of finding that structure, fine-tuning it over the course of many, many drafts. I'm proud of what ultimately emerged, but it was a long and winding road.
Oh, goodness me, the power of editors. I remember a book I did about the design of the London Underground, and I thought I had it all together, and I'd done a load of research like you did, and I presented it, and the editor said, okay, have you thought about reordering it a bit like this? And of course, they were right, and I hadn't thought of that, and it was a brilliant idea. So all praise to very, very clever editors who don't destroy your work, but
yes,
help you
absolutely
find a way through it. You start the book off with a riveting chapter you call The Cult of the Single Family Home. What does that mean exactly, Ben?
So it's a riff on this term in American history called the cult of domesticity. I'm not sure if there's an analog in the UK. I know there were some similar themes in 19th century thought here over in the UK as well. But it's basically, this chapter is exploring how some of these same cultural values that went into the cult of domesticity, a notion of private women's sphere that was sort of free of the corrupting elements of the city, a sort of deep sense of religiosity, and also nationalism, how those themes are kind of rolled up in the public policy that became single-family zoning in the U.S., and how to really understand, you know, the story of urban development of American cities, you have to reckon with some of those cultural values that are baked into the built environment.
That's a real strange thing for a European to read, is how a city has been zoned.
Yeah, I understand that in many other countries, single-family zoning doesn't exist. I believe Germany and Japan, for two that I know, there's really no such thing. It is a pretty uniquely American thing that it's pretty hard to overstate how much of the American built environment is single-family zoned. It certainly characterizes the prototypical Leave It to Beaver or, you know, the television show Weeds kind of aesthetic of American suburbs. But it goes way beyond that to just almost any kind of American neighborhood you can imagine, the vast majority of them. The only thing that exists there and the only thing that you could potentially build there is a single family home.
And it's a particular problem for planning transit as well, isn't it? Because it's not very dense. So where would you put the mass transit line or wherever? It does cause problems for moving people around.
Exactly. It essentially freezes a neighborhood in amber. So if you would want to plan a transit line, and you continue to leave a neighborhood zoned for single family homes, that transit line will never be successful. And that's something we've seen, unfortunately, in a lot of cities, particularly in the sort of western half of the US, the newer Sunbelt cities, where they built light rail systems, but often did not allow much new housing to go up near the stations.
You move on to discuss the particular issue of how some Americans, anyway, regard living in apartments. Is that much different, do you think, to, say, for example, the European outlook on flats, as we call them?
Well, I can't really speak to, you know, European sensibilities, but I know in America there's a huge stigma against apartment living, partly because of this cult of the single-family home that I was just talking about, this idea that the single-family home represents, you know, the triumph of the American dream. But I think another piece of it is the fact that in the US, apartments that were built in the last 20 or 30 years are often quite poorly designed. They are typically built along what are called double-loaded corridors, so effectively like a hotel-style layout with a hallway and apartments on either side. And what that means, in effect, is that each unit only has one exposure, and that means you could probably only build a one-bedroom apartment. And it means you can't do cross ventilation and you can't be very creative with the layout of the, you know, interior design of the unit. And in other countries, and certainly in America's history, there have been much more creative, much more livable apartment layouts with, you know, a lot more natural light, a lot more cross ventilation, the opportunity to create more bedrooms because you have more windows, and maybe a more communal atmosphere around a courtyard or, you know, a shared sort of stairwell atrium. That's sort of in the classic Central European apartment design. So part of what I'm trying to do with the chapter on apartments is to show that apartment living can be so much more than what it is perceived to be by the masses of people in the US.
We can do so much better effectively.
Yeah.
One of the major issues you cite in your new book, Ben, is that of the mall. Now, we have huge out-of-town shopping centres here in the UK, so we know what a mall is. But how do you think they've affected the structure of cities, in your view?
Malls are a really interesting part of the American landscape because they go part of the way towards providing the full spectrum of what a city centre ought to provide. They bring a lot of people together. They offer a lot of shopping and sometimes entertainment, but then they kind of stop. They don't provide the civic infrastructure like schools or post offices or healthcare institutions. They often don't have offices, and they almost never have housing nearby or on top of or within them. And that's an issue for creating urban centers that have a real city-like feel. And so I think malls are deficient, but they're also an exciting opportunity for American cities to look to create new urban centers in the suburbs that do have all of these things that I just described. And I think they're already part of the way there. So it's not such a heavy lift to then go and add the housing and the healthcare and the offices and make these places into more of town centers. Very often there's an enormous parking lot where those things could be built. And we're starting to see a few projects like this in the US, but there's a huge amount of potential to create a lot of housing, create new urban centers in American cities in the suburbs on these mall campuses.
Yeah, because you often see them and they are absolutely surrounded by car parking spaces.
Yes.
And you think, well, you don't have to have surface car parks. You could actually build something on top of them. If you need to have the parking, it can be underneath. And then above that, you can put your offices and shops and schools and places for people to live.
Right. And once you've got all of the housing on site, you're going to need less parking because many of the customers are able to just walk to the shops or walk to the offices.
It's exciting to hear that there are some small projects starting to take notice of people like you.
Yeah, definitely. There's quite a bit of action happening in the most expensive suburban areas of the US, Silicon Valley, Northern Virginia. These are very affluent areas where real estate is very expensive, where there's a number of these mall conversion projects ongoing right now.
Now, what first drew me to your work was how you explain about the importance of public transport, transit in US terms, and how we move people around. It's a large section of your book. So what does transit look like in most US cities?
Well, unfortunately, outside of New York City as this sort of first tier, and then San Francisco, Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. as a second tier, basically every other city, public transport is a pretty sorry state of transportation. It's really almost always going to be a lot slower and less convenient than driving somewhere. And the folks who use it tend to be the people with no other option, the people with the lowest incomes, people with disabilities, elderly people. And that is a product of the built environment itself, of these neighborhoods in America that are lacking in density, that are very single use. They don't have businesses and homes close together, and of choices by policymakers to disinvest in those systems. And even in that second tier of cities that I was talking about, transit really only works well in a sort of pretty small part of the urban core of those cities. And even then, I think... when I say it works well, it doesn't really compare to how well transit works in many other countries. Again, that's largely a product of disinvestment over a very long period of time. I think you'll find, if you're a visitor to the US, that these systems just haven't been updated often since they were built 100 years ago. The New York City subway notoriously is a museum-like relic, I would say, and which can be very cool and atmospheric, but it could certainly use a lot of new technology that it currently lacks.
Yeah, I remember going to one of those cities, to Boston, thinking, oh, great, they got a transit system. And I arrived on the platform and it said, next train, 19 minutes. I thought, well, that's a bit weird. Something must be going on. And every time I tried to take the T in Boston, it was always a 15, 16, 17, 20 minute wait. And you think, hang on a second, if you ran the trains more often, more people would use it, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's an all too common experience, unfortunately, for transit riders in the US, is these really long waits. Again, I think it's a sign of a lack of respect for people that take these transportation options. You know, their time is not viewed as valuable as the drivers for whom these enormous freeways are designed to save, you know, 30 seconds on a trip. They'll spend billions of dollars extra to widen a freeway, for instance. So yeah, it's both a urbanistic challenge and also a political and policy challenge.
Yeah, and when transit isn't very good, basically those urban areas are not doing so well. I'm thinking of somewhere like maybe Detroit, which has been sort of completely hollowed out.
Yeah, and Detroit is a somewhat unique case in that they just had massive depopulation. Population of the city is about half of what it was at its historical peak. So these neighborhoods that once were dense enough to support transit are really not anymore. But many versions of this same story have played out in a lot of American cities that I think by now many cities have kind of climbed out of their what's called the urban crisis of the 1970s and 80s, where many of them were quite depopulated. But there's still relics of that in both the built environment and in the sort of policies that governments have towards their most urban systems, of which transit, you know, is the most important.
And something that we're not doing in this country very well either is when we go to build new housing, we're not putting it on the old, we call it brownfield land that's been used once before. We're sticking it out in the fields in the countryside. It doesn't seem very sensible.
Yes. And obviously the US is notorious for its sprawling cities. A lot of the urban development that has happened in the US in the last 20, 30, 40 years has happened in what we call the Sun Belt, which is basically the southern half of the US minus California. States like Texas, Florida, the Carolinas, Arizona, Nevada. These are the places where a significant amount of housing has been built, which has been really good for housing costs in those places. But the flip side is that the urban design of many of these neighborhoods is this sprawling pattern that we're talking about. It's eating into agricultural land and open space and causing, you know, these massive traffic jams in cities because driving is the only way to get around. You know, unfortunately, these are the places that many people who would like to stay in a place like New York or California are effectively forced to move because that's where the affordable housing in this country exists.
You've talked about a few places where there have been some improvements. How do we kickstart that change? Is it just for urban planners to address, or does it need the involvement of the general public?
I think cultural change is really important to kickstart, as you say, the transformation of the built environment. I think in the US, there's been this cultural sensibility for decades now that the current state of the built environment is more or less the way that things will always be. And I think that's a toxic way to view your surroundings. It means that you're forever going to be saddled with a built environment that might reflect values from decades or even a century or more ago and is not able to adapt to the changing needs of the community. So I think it's just such an important first step to try to communicate that cities don't have to be as they are now, that there are some really exciting forms of technology in terms of transportation and design, in terms of housing and office buildings and the layout of neighborhoods that could make cities really nice and better. It doesn't have to be a downgrade to have new things in a city.
It sounds like you've pretty much worked out what we need to do to improve things. Please tell us more about when the book is out and how people can get it.
Yes, it's out on October 21st. It's available on Amazon, on bookshop.org, or on the website of my publisher, Island Press. Yeah, please go out and get it. I think you'll enjoy.
It's been so interesting to talk with a fellow transit and urban spaces lover. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thanks, Mark. It's been a blast.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Benjamin as much as I have. His new book is called The Unfinished Metropolis, Igniting the City, Building Revolution. And as he says, it's available on all book websites and stores from the 21st of October. You can also find more about him, for example, at his website, which is urbanschneider.com. And please look him up when you can. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We are doing more chatting art, transport, communications and history, so please do join us then.